Y'all, Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Amber the Petty.
That doesn't, no, that makes her sound, it that makes sounds her sound insulting.
Petty.
Yeah.
It makes her sound petty. How about the Amber Petty?
That's better.
Her name is just Amber Petty. There's actually no name. There's no the.
No. Amber Petty.
We're just trying to be, look, I was just trying to make it snappy. Make it jazzy.
Just read the copy.
Would you like to learn things from Amber Petty? For example, how to write? Would you like to try freelance writing, but have no idea where to start? You keep saying, I'm going to start writing tomorrow. And many tomorrows have passed. Stop doing that. Join Amber Petty's free workshop. This 60-minute workshop will take you through Freelance Writing 101. And you will start writing in class. By the end of that hour, you'll walk away with a list of story ideas, places to pitch, and a start on a spec piece. Like Carmela Soprano's spec house.
My spec house!
The first workshop, or rather, the next workshop, is this Thursday, September 16th at 4 p.m. Pacific.
Get on it.
Live on Zoom. That's 3 days from now. Yeah. You better be listening to this episode.
The moment it drops.
So that you can get in on Amber Petty's workshop. You want to see all the other dates and times? Go to amberpetty.com/linoleum. It is free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A podcast of the cinema.
But I already said Linoleum Knife once.
Well, I know, but this is now it's official.
Linoleum Knife is a podcast that is hosted by me. My name is Dave White. I'm a film critic for The Wrap. I'm married to the other co-host. His name is Alonzo Duralde. Say something.
I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host of other podcasts, including Breakfast All Day, A Maximum Film, and sometimes Deck the Hallmark. You said we're married. We covered that part.
We got that part already.
Yeah.
You know, Alonzo.
Yes, Dave.
In a marriage, there should be no secrets.
Says who?
But yet, you got a package in the mail yesterday or the day before or whenever. Mm-hmm. You opened it up surreptitiously and scurried off to your hiding place with the item. Today I found that item.
Well, look, sometimes
who's embarrassed by the thing they bought? I would like to let's dig in.
Here's the thing. I am currently in the process of purchasing Christmas presents from you
for me.
Many of which as is our wont, we give each other a lot of books.
We do we mostly give each other books for Christmas.
Yeah.
This is correct.
So I had a book that was coming from bookshop.org where I've been ordering a lot of stuff.
Yes.
So I went to the back to open it, thinking that if it was one of your Christmas books, I didn't want you to see it. It was gonna go right into the drawer of secrets. It wasn't, but there was no need for me to bring it back out and show it to you.
Oh yes, there was. Because when I found it,
I cannot believe you're putting me on blast.
When I found it, oh, like this is embarrassing compared to like all the other Christmassy things that you're into. Every damn Hallmark-ish movie on like Up TV or whatever. Look, the Hallmark ones are the good ones compared to the ones you see on these other channels.
Look, and I don't watch everything. You'd be shocked.
So now there's a book in the back called like The Coco Marshmallow Murder or something like that? Is that what it is?
Christmas Coco Murder.
Christmas Coco Murder.
There is a publisher that puts out Cozy Mysteries.
Coco Mysteries.
Coco Mysteries. Cozy Mysteries. And every year at the holidays, they put out...
Pause to sip water.
Yes. They put out a compilation of... They get three of their authors to do sort of novellas, like sort of short mysteries.
Ooh, a novella.
Yes. Mm. That are set during the holidays.
And this they sounds like capital L literature to me
they
now.
They always have a theme. So like they've done one that's like eggnog murder. They've done like Yule log murder, whatever.
Wait, isn't the eggnog murder paperback the one we fought about that day at Barnes & Noble?
I think it was.
Because you bought it? And I said, how much you spent on that? You said $8. I said, okay, no candy at the movie theater then. Budget, budget, budget.
Because here's what I've learned about.
You got mad at me, and then you were angry about it for months.
Yeah, you have
told
been.
All our friends, and basically they all came to me and said, why are you so mean to Alonzo?
Yeah. Why can't it's I like, spend $8 on
budget.
A whim when I feel like
we
it?
We got a budget. We live on a budget.
Anyway, what I've discovered is I don't love... a cozy mystery novel, like I kind of lose interest, but I
well,
love
it. How can that be? What isn't, I thought the writing was so strong that you would never lose interest in a mystery novel.
But I like a cozy mystery novella because they have to wrap it up pretty quick.
Hey, there's a murder. Look, there's a cup of cocoa. Let's take some prints. Hey, we found the murderer from the prints on the cup of cocoa. The end. Merry Christmas.
You're not too far off.
I am not too far off. I knew it wasn't too far off.
Anyway, so no, I was not hiding it from you. Mm. I was opening it in the back because I thought it might have been one of your Christmas presents.
Right. But it wasn't.
It wasn't.
It was the cocoa cookie, sugar boo boo bum bum, gaga goo goo, pee pee poo poo murder.
Yeah, that didn't fit on the cover.
Next time.
You're terrible.
No, I'm not. Those books are terrible.
How would you know?
I just know.
Okay, fine. Great. Next time you try and get me to go to some art gallery to see some rising young star that you're all into, I'm going to be like, oh, that's garbage. How do you know? I just know.
No, you see, here's the thing. You don't. Yeah. You don't.
Oh, of course.
Know.
Yes. All right. It's always different when it's you. It is. And your unerring taste.
I thought that was established, my impeccable taste.
Yeah.
It's established in my mind.
Clearly, firmly, nowhere else.
Speaking of mysteries.
Yes.
We have one. Now, it is not a mystery who sent us the tasty cakes.
Right.
Thank you, Movie John.
Yes, thank you.
Spiking my blood sugar from here to...
With the flavor of the Northeast.
Here to the moon and back. Somebody sent us a book called Lair, and it's a big coffee table art book about movie villains' homes.
No, I think that was somebody sent it to us like we were going to review it or something.
Really?
Yeah.
Where would we do that?
I don't know.
On the this.
Well, review. You just said the title, so I guess it
all
works.
All right. Well, I mean, it's a cool book. Is that the review?
I haven't looked at it.
I just thought someone listening sent it to us.
No.
You think it came from a publisher?
Yes. The mystery gift.
The mystery gift.
Yes.
Is a box of macaron.
Mm-hmm.
Not macaroons. Macaron. Y'all know the difference?
Yeah.
Go look it up. Google
I like
it.
A macaroon, too.
If
don't
you don't,
get me wrong.
We love macaroons. We love macaron.
Yeah.
But
they are not the same
listen
thing.
To me speak French right now. I'm not even pronouncing that hard N like an American, even though I am one and would do it. If it hadn't been drilled into my head how to pronounce this word. I still can't say croissant properly, but...
You're pretty close.
Eh. But I can do a macaron.
There you go.
And someone sent us a not little box.
No.
Of a variety.
Yes.
Like a wild assortment.
And a few shortbreads to boot.
And there's no name attached.
No
and
gift
I'll
received.
Tell you something. I love a present. Everyone loves a present. But I also need to be able to tell you thank you.
Yes.
So, look, if you're the guilty party.
Fess up.
Then confess, please. Because I need to, you know, I need to know who's filling my mouth with enjoyment. It can't be anonymous.
That's about to become a ringtone.
No. We're film critics, by the way.
Hello.
We have some movies to talk about. We have four, in fact. And we're going to make it snappy so we can get this wrapped up and I can start making dinner.
Great.
It's Monday afternoon at 4 p.m., which is why 5 o'clock, that's dinner-making time.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Oh, what a delightful dinner you're getting tonight, too. Vegetables and whole grains. Yeah, I know you could. I knew you were going to be excited.
Do you like brown rice?
Health, darling. This is farro. It's not even brown rice.
I like
this fancy farro.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's begin with our film discussions.
Why not?
Malignant.
Which we are not going to spoil.
We will not. All right, I'll tell you something. We invoke the precious name of April Wolf all the time. Her oft-repeated expression, it's not what happens, it's how it happens. Therefore, spoilers don't matter. And I am generally of that opinion myself. Except for this movie. Because we watched this last night on HBO Max. Apparently, it's not making any money at the box office because it is also on HBO Max. Everyone's talking about it on the internet.
Yes.
But apparently people didn't rush out to the movie theater to buy a ticket to it, which makes sense to me.
You would be forgiven for not knowing that this was a movie that was coming to movie theaters.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, I had all the horror people I know, they were all about it.
Sure.
Talking about it before it came
but
out.
I mean, I had not, as far as like actual marketing for it, I had not seen much at all.
Well, this is a new film from James Wan.
Yes.
Who gave us The Saws.
Yes, and The Conjurings.
And The Conjurings, and The Insidiouses.
And Fast 7.
And Fast Furious 7. And the Aquamans.
Yeah.
Here's a new one. And every frame of this movie screams, I got Final Cut.
Yeah, this is a classic one for me.
No producers or any studio executive people were allowed on set. I did it my way or the highway.
I made you an Aquaman. I'm making you another Aquaman. Just give me this.
Now you're going to give me some money to make this thing and you're going to butt right out.
Yeah.
Because I have some wacky stuff I want to indulge.
Yeah.
And he did that. The bare bones plot is that there is a young woman named Madison in her 30s. And is she like a nurse? Yeah.
Nurse like or that. Home care worker, something like that.
She's pregnant. She has an abusive spouse. So you should know that actually right away. Within the first 10 minutes, there is a scene of spousal abuse. It is not, it's shocking. And it's in keeping with what a horrific thing it is, they show you the horrific nature of this. If this were any other movie, I would say, why did you need that? However, in this film, it is a vital, instigating event.
Yes.
And it takes, the aftermath of this moment takes our young heroine on a journey of self-discovery.
That's fair.
Where wackier and wackier stuff happens until it's over. The end. That's all you're getting out of me.
Yeah. I am not.
There's a bad, malevolent creature that is killing people.
Yes.
And she has to figure out why and who and what it has to do with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what it has to do with that moment of abuse from her husband.
I am not a horror guy. I do not go out of my way for movies like this. But so many people on Twitter were talking about it.
Yeah.
And talking about it in such a way of like, OMG, this is so bananas. Yeah. This is so, is it Jallo? Is it not? Is it just tongue in cheek? I don't know what it is.
There's a little dollop of Jallo here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Framing, but, lighting.
But it was
score, noises.
It was very like, you got to see this. And enough people were saying it in such a way where I thought, okay, I do got to see this.
Right.
And this is the kind of movie that I love if I'm going to watch something that is gory and
it's gross. Really gory.
Yeah.
It is there's a lot of point of impact killing. They don't pull the camera away. You get to see the stabbing and the chopping up.
Yeah. I mean, it is not in any way like the Stuart Gordon films of the 80s, like Reanimator and From Beyond, except that it's the kind of thing where it provides a point for me to meet horror halfway.
Yes.
And I found it crazily entertaining and really fun.
More than that, more than the wildness of what unfolds, that wildness is horror referential.
Sure, yes.
Not just, as we said, dollops of Jallo, but direct references to
certain films,
classic horror films,
yeah,
that you may know if you are, you know, into that sort of thing. It also takes the idea of The Final Girl and, how do I say this without giving stuff away? The idea of self-knowledge becoming your power.
Sure.
That is absolutely part of this.
Yeah.
And on that level, it is also, for me, quite satisfying.
Yes.
Because I'll tell you again, that first scene of the husband,
yes,
harming her, I was like, I don't know about this. How much of this are we going to get in this movie? Because I'm fed up with that as a thing that can casually happen in a film.
Right. And this movie is not doing it casually or exploitatively.
And so what happens later on is fully informed by that moment. And so
and I think also
I found that aspect of it very satisfying.
Yes. And I think that you learn things about her out of that relationship that reflect on other aspects of her life as well.
Yeah. So, and then there's the way it looks. There are so many awesome shots of, you know, I'm talking about compositionally.
Yes.
There are just really wonderful moments that are sometimes beautiful and sometimes freaky to the point where you think, wait, how did they light this? and also, okay, here's a spoiler. The most hilarious park a car scene I've witnessed in a film in years. And I know that doesn't sound like anything, but
you'll know it when you see it. There are overhead shots like inside a house that are so vertiginously high.
Yeah.
It's like, what, do they have like 80-foot ceilings in this plane? What's going on?
There's a lot of fun he's having with the camera. There's a lot of, you know, show-offy stuff, which I always appreciate if you can also tell that the filmmaker is having fun showing off and not just trying to, you know, be meaningful or whatever.
Blow your mind.
Yeah, I just... it's worth your time. Unless, of course, you know, this kind of violence and this kind of gore is already an absolute no for you, then, you know yourself. Go or don't go.
But, you know, bear in mind, if you are somebody like me who, generally speaking, would just as soon not, but who does kind of dig it when it's being used in a way that is shocking, not in a visceral way, but shocking in terms of just unpredictable and unexpected and somebody who really understands what they're doing as a craftsperson making film.
Right.
You'll have I think you'll really get a lot out of it.
Yeah. You and I are the opposite. you are not a horror enjoyer, generally.
That is true.
But for me, September and October, while not the months that I limit horror watching to, they are the months when I start thinking, what scary, gross thing can I look at? It's the spooky times.
Not for me.
September and October, it's the spooky times, and it's time for me to watch, you know, what?
I don't know.
It's Alive.
Oh, always
Alive. Again, at the annual It's a Wonderful Life of Horror. It's Alive. It's a Wonderful Alive. And then it's Alive 2 and Island of the Alive and, you know, the good stuff.
Ugh. If you're going to watch Larry Cohen, you could at least watch, like, Q of the Winged Serpent or something.
Sure you could. Or you could watch his greatest film, It's Alive.
Sure, Jan.
The best movie of all time.
God.
It's Alive.
Just because it... Was it great or were you eight?
Yes. Oh, no, I was not allowed.
Right, but you...
When I was eight, there was like... here's the thing.
You desperately wanted to, so once
that
you did
movie
see it,
was
you
rated
decided...
PG, okay?
Yeah, I know.
But let me tell you something. Like, eight... In PG in 1970, like, two or three or four, whenever it was. I'm like 8, 9 years old. Oh, no. That was not happening for me yet. I was not allowed... I wanted to. I wanted an older person in the home to be like, can we go see the movie about the monster baby? And they're like, no. No, you're not watching that. I was like, but see, the poster had the little claw coming out of the crib. And I was like, but I have to see the rest of the monster. Like, all I have right now in my head is my imagination of what the monster looks like. And I need to see the rest of the monster. Because all I can see in the poster is the little claw coming out of the crib. Don't you understand that my imagination is far more terrifying than what could be in this film? That was the case I made.
To deaf ears.
To deaf ears.
Oh, well.
Yes.
Poor you.
So I didn't get to see it until I was a teenager. And, you know, you never forget your first love.
Well, if this is a horror movie season for you, you should absolutely be watching.
It's Alive.
Malignant.
Malignant also, yes.
Totally skip It's Alive.
You cannot.
Linoleum Knife is also brought to you by our
correct.
Friends at Ovid.tv.
Where you can watch It's Alive
no,
this month.
No.
I don't think Ovid has ever shown It's Alive.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No. And that's, I think, a vote in their favor. No, they're here for the Serioso. The art house, the foreign, the independent, the documentary, shorts, you name it. They got it at Ovid. The good stuff, the deep cuts. Dropping this Wednesday, September 15th, is a new 2K restoration of Helene Klodowski's Painted Landscape of the Times, which introduces the work of artist Sue Coe. This is produced early in her career. It's the only film about her work. Her visual journalism has a keen ideological thrust that identifies and addresses aberrations in our society. This is an acclaimed film, and you are not going to find it anywhere else. It is streaming exclusively on Ovid. Also coming on the 17th is Shuli Cheng's Fresh Kill. This takes me back. I remember we screened this movie at the USA Film Festival back in the day. It's a film from 1994. Cheng was a pioneering digital artist, and this is an experimental comedy about young lesbian parents fighting against environmental racism in the form of radioactive fish lips. It is an Ovid exclusive. It is a streaming premiere. You're only going to find it there. Where are you going to find Ovid? Why? At Ovid.tv, of course. They've got a free trial. Dig into their extensive menu of the kind of films you're just not going to find in other services. And, you know, check out their monthly and annual rates. See what's right for you.
It's cheap to subscribe to them. And they are really worth your money. Because that stuff they have, you're not going to find it, like, anywhere else.
No. Are Bea and Whitney still doing their Ovid podcast?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so you can, like, you know, follow up and get more insight about these films. Listen to them.
OVID, better than that old Roman poet.
That's right. What did he know?
All right. Moving on. We have another movie to talk about.
We have several more.
Yeah, we do. Fauci.
Yes.
Documentary about Anthony Fauci.
Mm-hmm.
From John Hoffman and Janet Tobias. It's for National Geographic. Is this in theaters or
it's in theaters right now.
Streaming or what?
It just premiered at Telluride. I assume because it's National Geographic that it'll be on Disney Plus
eventually.
At some point, but right now it's in theaters.
So this is a documentary about the life of Anthony Fauci. And, you know, it's been quite a life. He's 80 at this point. And he has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since the 80s. He's gone through presidential administration after presidential administration. Two of the worst, in fact.
Yes.
He was there in the 80s for Ronald Reagan's blatant dismissal and ignoring of the AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, as everyone knows, he has been the thorn in Donald Trump's side all during COVID. Although, you know, not that it mattered to Trump, but
no.
It's a story of this man who has very steadfastly, doggedly worked for the public health. And it takes you from the beginning, from his medical school years, all the way to now. One thing that I remember from the 80s was, you and I were both part of ACT UP.
Yes.
In the late 80s, early 90s. And, well, I became part of ACT UP in 1991. And you were, I think, a little earlier than that, or?
Like 90, I think.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, at the time, you know, the mindset among AIDS activists was, well, this guy is a villain.
Right.
Because he is part of this governmental establishment that is not moving fast enough while people are dying.
Yes.
You know.
He's getting in the way of speedier drug trials, of, you know, things that, you know, this is a disease where people don't live a long time. We don't
after
have time.
After diagnosis. We don't have time for science to do its normal, slow thing. And science is slow.
Yeah.
Particularly when science is confronted with a brand new thing like HIV. It took them years to figure out what was even causing AIDS. And then it took even longer to come up with anything resembling a treatment
right.
that would help anyone. And mostly you can blame Ronald Reagan for that and the Republicans, because Fauci was simply, you know, the head of an organization that was trying to do, methodical, responsible science.
Right. The National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases.
Yes. And so one of the things you see in this documentary is ACT UP confronting him.
Yes.
And him at first being defensive and saying, you don't understand that science is slow. And we're facing something that we don't understand, and so we're still doing research we don't know. And ACT UP was like, what do you got right now?
Yeah.
Like, we'll take anything. And a sort of shocking and revolutionary thing that he did was he invited ACT UP to participate in
the World AIDS Conference.
In the World AIDS Conference, he attended ACT UP New York meetings and was like, ask me anything.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to help in any way I can. And so it turned out he was not a villain. He just needed to be, you know, woken up to the urgency of what was happening, you know, on the ground with people who were desperate for anything that would save their life.
And I think this is a thing that is not necessarily uncommon in the field of medicine and science, where you get so wrapped up in the laboratory of it all, the sort of research of it all, that you lose sight of the fact
that's his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is established in the film.
This comes down to human beings,
right?
You know, who are dealing with stuff and need to have those needs addressed. And so, yeah, the fact that he was able to kind of come around and, you know, be open to what they were screaming at him, literally.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, like a lot of people wouldn't and didn't. And so that was a very big deal. It's funny that while we're saying this, I pulled up the IMDb page.
Yes.
And the way that internet trolls love to do,
yes,
a million people have gone on the Fauci page and given it a 1-star rating,
right,
without having seen it.
No,
because
they haven't seen it.
Because
they want him in prison for some reason.
Yeah, their Lord and Savior Trump has told them that he's the enemy.
Right. Here, and the film very, very, very much covers COVID,
yes,
as well. And the radical ignorance of people who are against any sort of government approach to this virus.
Yeah.
So COVID shows up and people are scrambling for information, and the and, you know, he becomes the face of that information.
Right.
And as it moves along, you know, he backs off of things he said at first and said, okay, well, no, we said that first, but now we're telling you this because,
yes,
we know more stuff now.
As though, like, that were flip-flopping and not just how science
evolves. A month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, yeah, the information changes. And he says, okay, I know we said this in the past, but that's not right anymore. You got to do this instead. You and I know from living last year that as information came, you had to adjust what you were doing. Oh, this kind of mask is more helpful than this other kind of mask.
Right.
You know, a negative test is not enough to protect you because there are too many other variables, you know, if you're going to go to Thanksgiving with your family.
Right.
And people resented that every step of the way. And they did so because Donald Trump, who is a worthless, criminal, horrible human being, just happened to be the president.
Yeah.
And got to try to contradict people who knew infinitely more than he ever will. And so you see all of that. And now we have a man who is still at the AID with security detail.
Yeah.
Because people want to kill him for trying to protect the public health.
Yeah. And it's like, you know what, folks? You don't want Fauci around? Enjoy your Ebola. You know,
right,
like this, he's been at the forefront of all this stuff. And the fact that
I
don't
know.
Get me started.
You're gonna start ranting. This is, because it is a National Geographic documentary, it is a very standard issue documentary.
Yes.
Lots of interviews, lots of talking heads, his family,
yeah,
in fact. Even George W. Bush and Bono. Sorry. But, like, it's the kind of documentary that is meant to let you know that this guy's been working hard for you for
decades,
about half a century now.
Yeah.
So recognize this, please. It's worth your time. I'm glad we watched it.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't innovative formally in any way, and it definitely sort of falls into what I call the authorized documentary. But, you know, yeah, I think given that he's had so much of the spotlight lately, a lot of people might not know about, you know, what went down in the 80s. And I think the film does a really smart job of sort of paralleling the AIDS crisis and the current, you know, COVID crisis, and how that position, you know, kind of puts a target on you.
And we have another documentary to,
yes,
talk about. It's called Unapologetic.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Ashley O'Shea. And it follows the day-to-day lives and social justice work of two young queer black women in Chicago, a woman named Janae Bonsu and another named Bella Boss. And they have very full plates.
Yes.
Janae's a graduate student. Bella is a rapper. And the film at the time, when the time of the film was in production, seems to be around 2017-ish. That's the timeline I could sort of figure out.
Yeah, the woman who is the current mayor of Chicago was at the time the head of the police board that these two protesters and so many other activists were coming face to face with over the conduct of Chicago police.
Right. They were both active in the movement to bring to justice the police officers who murdered Rekia Boyd and Laquan McDonald. So what you see them doing through the course of this film is protesting, disrupting police board and city administration meetings.
Lori Lightfoot is her name.
Lori Lightfoot, yeah, at the time was the head of that board. Now she's the mayor.
Right.
They are rebuffed time after time, and they do not stop coming. They belong to a group called BYP 100, Black Youth Project.
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And they keep, through the course of the doc, they keep working for policy changes. They do that primarily through direct action. And but you also see their personal lives. You know, it's activist filmmaking, clearly.
Yeah.
And importantly so. But it's also really intimate and personal. And just like the Fauci doc, it doesn't reinvent any wheels. You know, it's more on the ground, first person, you know, you are there style doc. There's not a lot of interviews other than with the young women themselves.
Yeah, and even those seem to kind of be organic in a moment when other things are happening.
They happen to be there and they'll turn and talk to the camera.
Yeah. You know?
But it's very concerned with the urgency of this crisis and the immediate need to organize people who will support that movement. And I think this is a really valuable movie because it's become very easy for mainstream media and people who don't know any better, who should know better, to dismiss movements like Black Lives Matter. And it allows, you know, right-wing reactionary people in the culture to misinform. When all it boils down to is people who are literally fighting for their lives.
Yes.
And the lives of people in their community. And this particular film is about, you know, young queer women centering themselves in that process.
It was interesting to watch this and the Fauci doc so close together because I was reminded of how ACT UP was sort of set up as this sort of amorphous, scary thing by the right-wing media.
Oh, yeah. You know. Oh, yes. I remember with ACT UP in Dallas, a suburb of Dallas, a far north suburb of Dallas, where they were taking AIDS education out of the health curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to take it out.
Yeah.
They had it, but they were going to remove it. And so ACT UP went to the school board meeting. We just walked in with big signs, and we were very quiet. We just stood there with our signs. And when it came time to speak, we were allowed to speak. But the cops showed up because when they showed up, they said, someone from the school board called us here. They said they thought you guys might be armed.
Oy.
And I talked to the cop. Because everyone else was like, oh no, the cops. I was like, let me talk to the cops. And I walk up to the cops. I go, no one's armed. ACT UP is not armed. ACT UP is never armed. We are here to protest curriculum changes in this school district. They're taking AIDS education out of the curriculum, and we want to express our disapproval. We are waiting patiently and quietly for our turn to speak. The loudest thing happening here is our signs. Would you like to watch? Like, and I'll answer any question you have other than, are we armed? And he was like, it's fine. Like, he was cool. Like, he suddenly was cool. He was like, it's fine.
Nowadays in Dallas, it's a problem if you aren't armed.
Probably. I know.
Yeah, no, but it you know, you labor unions and, you know, the suffrage movement, you know, the civil rights movement, it's always the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it can't just be people who have, like, you know, a point to make and a moral drive to do so. It's all, no, bomb-throwing anarchists
right.
who are here to poison your cistern, you know?
I changed, this is like 2 years ago, I changed my Twitter name to Antifa Tea Time. And someone asked me, someone really sort of blustered, like, why'd you do that? I said, it's two things I like. They're like, you like Antifa? I said, the opposite is something that no one should like. Because the opposite of Antifa is fascism. Hence the name.
Yes.
They're anti-fascist. You dummy. You block.
You profile idiot.
Anyway, this documentary is called Unapologetic.
Yes, it is.
And it is effective and it's important work being done here by Ashley O'Shea. It's in virtual cinemas right now. It's also in art houses.
Yeah.
Where you can see little docs like this.
And I'll tell you, it is inspiring in the best way. I think it's very easy to get, to feel defeated, to feel cynical about how slow, you know, if at all, things change in this country. And, you know, seeing young, committed, smart, effective activists doing their thing, you know, like, it made me feel better.
Yeah, well, I mean, also... there is the connection of queerness.
Yeah.
That necessitates queers like us, who are not young or black or women. It necessitates people like us to support and, you know, amplify that stuff.
Yes.
Because unless young queer black women are free, neither are we.
Absolutely.
So, let's talk about the new Paul Schrader movie.
Okay. Yes, The Card Counter, which just premiered at Venice and is now in theaters, stars Oscar Isaac as a character who goes by the name William Tell. He is, as the title suggests, a card counter. He can go to a casino.
Card counter and arm kisser.
He can play. He can play blackjack. He can play poker, and he keeps a count in his head, and that allows him to win. And as long as he doesn't win giant pots,
right?
Casinos don't hassle him. And also, he tends to stay to the more off the beaten path casinos that are kind of just sort of out in the middle of nowhere. And so the entire movie feels like it's set in one kind of airport bar after another. Like everything is just crushingly, you know, mundane and similar. And you know, they don't go to Vegas in this movie. They go to like Chippewa Falls or something. Yeah. It's all very just kind of bleh. and it's Paul Schrader doing the movie that Paul Schrader has to do every few years, which is about a man alone, you know, by night, playing by his own rules.
I want to talk about...
seeking redemption.
You're not being serious enough about this.
Okay, fine.
It's all fun and games until we start talking about Bresson-influenced cinema.
Yeah.
But I just want you to know.
He is playing the hits here.
I think there is a difference between playing the hits and returning to themes that that keep you in the game of filmmaking. Because what you're seeing here is a film. It's not just that he's a card counter and he goes from casino to casino, casino to casino. He has reasons.
Yes.
His reasons are that he has been in prison. And in prison, he learned that a small, contained life kind of suits him just fine, especially since what sent him to prison was hell on earth.
Yes.
He was at Abu Ghraib. He was torturing prisoners for the United States. And he got sent to prison for it while the private contractor who trained him, Willem Dafoe, now gets paid big money to go around on speaking tours.
As a security consultant.
Yes. So, in the process of Oscar Isaac's casino lifestyle, he comes into contact with Willem Dafoe again. He also comes into contact with young Ty Sheridan.
Yes.
Who...
I was getting there.
Were you, though?
Yes.
All right. Tell what was going to... Tell where you were going.
He encounters Ty Sheridan, who has...
Pass the ball to you.
Who has his own reasons for wanting to track down Willem Dafoe. And unlike Oscar Isaac, who seems content to try to escape the past... is obsessed with revenge.
Yes.
Also along for all of this is Tiffany Haddish.
Yes.
Who apparently said that Schrader complained about her sing-songy voice and,
yes,
like, tried to make her not talk that way.
Oh, he did it too.
Yeah. So it's she's giving a much more subdued line readings than you might expect from Tiffany Haddish.
Tiffany Haddish is a force of nature.
Yes.
If you've seen Girls Trip, you know that she can take a movie and walk away with it. And make you happy that she did it.
Yes.
So the interview that you're referencing, where she talks about what Paul Schrader asked her to do with her voice, I think it's from the New York Times. And she said, yeah, he told me I had a sing-songy voice. I said, no, I don't. He said, yes, you do. And I don't want you to use it in this film. And she, you know, tried and tried and tried, and then she realized, oh yeah, I do have a sing-songy voice. And so the work for her was to be not a force of nature, to become part of the atmosphere of this film, which is one of subdued, not necessarily emotionless dialogue, but everything sort of weighing the same.
It's, with exceptions, it's, much of it is sort of chilly and impersonal.
When Oscar Isaac is speaking about his time in Abu Ghraib or his time in prison or about poker, he is speaking about it in the same tone. Nothing makes him go up or down.
Oh, yeah. No, he narrates like the strategies of poker over the film. But he does so in, like, the most,
right,
flat way,
right,
possible.
And that is a Bressanian thing.
Yes.
Now, what Paul...
no acting here.
What Paul... Well, no. What Paul Schrader does is not what Bresson does.
Okay.
Bresson would make his actors repeat the line again and again and again until they had stripped away all evidence of performance, all indications that they were actors acting. He wanted absolute removal of the theatrical process. Schrader doesn't do that. These actors are acting.
Yes.
He's allowing them to act. He is not turning them into models, which is what Bresson called his
right
people.
No, I was referring to Bresson, not to Schrader.
Right. So the kind of performances you're seeing here are very, very tamped down.
Yes, but...
Okay.
We just watched David Cronenberg's Crash again.
Yes.
Which has a similar performance style.
Mm-hmm.
And those characters felt far more vivid to me.
Really?
Than either Isaac or even Haddish in this movie. They... In this movie, everybody just sort of seems like they are drowning in cold water, and not in a particular...
They are.
Not in a way that I found all that compelling.
Not literally, but they are.
And I think that part of it is that, again, to go back to where I started here.
Okay.
I feel like Schrader's made this movie like 4 or 5 times now.
Right. He has.
And he's made it better than he's making it here. I think that Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe.
Yes.
You know, American Gigolo. You
yes.
know, his screenplay for Taxi Driver, which is not a movie that I love, but I respect. I feel like he's tackled these themes of redemption and men and violence and haunted pasts and whatever. More interestingly, and I felt like... When I watch Holly Hunter in Crash,
okay,
I get that she is a performer who is capable of all kinds of things and that this is one of those things that no one has ever asked her to do before. And when I watch Oscar Isaac in this, I feel like, why are you doing this to Oscar Isaac?
Okay.
Like, I felt like of all the of the various colors, you know, in his paint box, that this drab eggshell is not one that I particularly wanted to see from him.
I want to suggest to you that the monotone acting style of Crash is in service of something completely different.
Well, yes, I'm not saying they're identical.
And so I don't think that you can talk about this apple and that orange.
Okay, then let's talk about Ethan Hawke in First Reform.
All right.
That's a movie of somebody who is, you know, again, similar deal, you know, haunted, redemption, yes. violence, the yes. whole thing. And that felt like a recognizable human being to me.
Yes.
I did not buy this character because, you know, there's just so much filigree to his blandness that it felt like a collection of screenwriter ideas more than a person.
I found Oscar Isaac magnetic in that framework.
Okay.
And I see in this character and in this film, again, I know it sounds like I'm being a broken record, but Bresson is the Well. Okay. Right. If he weren't, Schrader wouldn't have written a book about him.
I was going to say.
Okay.
Yes.
Bresson is the Well. So his characters are diarists, and that's because a country priest wrote a diary for Bresson. And this particular character, unlike Travis Bickle, unlike Ethan Hawke in First Reformed, has had the life drained out of him. Partially through his own choices, partially through choices that were forced upon him. And now he wants to just either be so unobtrusive as to not make a noise everywhere he goes. He doesn't even want furniture to distract him in his rooms. He covers it with cloth everywhere he goes so that details of stuff are not in his field of vision. He either wants to be as small as possible and take up as little space as possible and win small amounts at small stakes games as possible, or failing that, he simply wants to die. He says this at least once or twice in the film. I was hoping this person would kill me. And that is absolutely, again, something that is referenced in a Bresson film called The Devil, probably, where you've got a young man who is determined to die by any means he can make happen. I'm not giving away plot details here, but this film differs from The Devil, probably, in many, many ways.
Well,
but I could feel echoes of it. And I could feel echoes of other Bresson films like L'Argent.
Mm-hmm.
In the style, because he is, as a filmmaker, Schrader is rigorously attached to the formal qualities of the directors he admires most.
Right. But you know what? Loving Hitchcock doesn't mean you like all of Brian De Palma's films.
That is correct.
Even the Hitchcocky ones.
That is correct.
And loving Bresson doesn't mean you have to love all of Schrader's
films. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that because I love Bresson, I also love all of Paul Schrader's movies. I've seen some that I did not care for.
Okay.
I find this one a full and whole experience that is meant to be as it is and is drained of color and drained of life until Tiffany Haddish shows up and tries in her way, in her character's way,
mm-hmm.
to pull Oscar Isaac into some other kind of reality. But he is absolutely resistant.
Yes.
Like, she is the moment of energy when she walks into a scene, in spite of the fact that she is, you know, much more subdued than you've ever seen her.
Right.
She carries with her that force that she is, which I think is why he cast her. You know, here's your chance. You could get out of the life you are trying to make for yourself, but we know you won't. I think this is a great movie. I think it's really, really beautiful and sad and moving. So
I think it's a copy of a copy of a copy. And I I'm saying this as somebody who loved First Reformed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a movie that, like, maybe the most Bresson on his sleeve that he's ever done.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's practically remaking Diary of a Country.
There are so many visual reference points to that and Winterlight. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know what you mean. And I understand your perspective.
You just don't share.
But I just think this is a great movie.
Okay.
So, got a streaming or DVD pick for people to look at?
I have a physical media pick that's actually coming out later in September, but it was just announced today, and it's very exciting.
Yes.
It is, Time Life is doing a Richard Pryor box set.
Oh, yeah?
A 13-disc set that will include all four of his concert films,
mm-hmm.
A couple of documentaries, a bunch of TV appearances, the four episodes of the canceled controversial NBC show, The Richard Pryor Show.
You know, I saw that show when it was on TV.
Me too.
Yeah.
Which Sandra Bernhard was on, and Marsha Warfield, and Tim Reed, and a bunch of other cool people. You know, like interviews and outtakes and one of his early film appearances that a lot of people haven't seen. It's just this really amazing collection. And, you know, Pryor is somebody who I think just as the years pass becomes more and more important as sort of a chronicler of American life. We just saw him in Wattstacks. I think that he's somebody that maybe younger viewers might have only a kind of a hazy recollection of, or like, you know, they might have seen some of his kind of dumb, you know, 80s movies. But, you know, like Superman 3 or whatever.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I think this is going to be, this is one of those things that I think it's that physical media exists for, these comprehensive collections,
yeah.
You know, that give you all this amazing stuff at your fingertips. So, yeah, the Time Life Richard Pryor box is my pick this week.
You sat me down and made me watch for the very first time in my life, finally, 1953's The Bandwagon.
Yes.
Fred Astaire, Sid Charisse, Nanette Fabre,
mm-hmm.
Oscar Levant,
Edgar Buchanan.
The plot is whatever. Fred Astaire, he's a song and dance man. His career is on the skids. He needs a show. He needs a hit. So they try to make a show, but no one likes it. So then they make a show that is about absolutely nothing. It's like a review. And then everybody likes it. The end. But that's not the point. The point is all of these amazing song and dance numbers that happen in the film, including the one with the babies. What's the...
Triplets.
Triplets, where...
Astaire, Fabre, and Anthony Buchanan.
And Anthony Buchanan are... Sorry, Jack Buchanan.
Oh, why am I saying Edgar?
I don't know. Jack Buchanan.
I don't know anything anymore.
Way to go, historian. Anyway, they dress up like baby triplets and sing a song about how they wish they could shoot each other with guns.
That's the one.
That's a good one. And then there is this show-stopping, breathtaking dance between Astaire and Sid Charisse in a park.
Yes.
Dancing in the dark. And... it makes all the new musicals where people are dancing look like the barf of puke, because the camera just follows them while they dance. And you see the perfection of what they do instead of a million cuts to trick you out of looking at them because they didn't have enough rehearsal time.
Right.
So yeah, you're not watching this movie for the plot, because the plot is whatever and dumb. You're watching it for the things you go to a musical for. The leaving behind of reality, and the entering of another world where the only thing that matters is how well you dance. A world I will never be allowed to live in.
But you can look at it from the outside.
I can look at it from the outside. It's so great. The Bandwagon.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad we finally watched it.
You know, I've seen That's Entertainment. Mm. So I've seen the major parts of it.
Uh-huh. But you didn't know the song That's Entertainment was from this movie.
But I didn't know the song That's Entertainment was from this movie. And when they start singing it, I thought, oh, that's from this movie? God, I hope they're finishing singing this song soon because the song drives me up the wall. It really does.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no, it totally does. The song That's Entertainment is like, it's like Smash Mouth's All Star. Like, oh. I don't need to hear it again.
Come on.
I've heard it one bajillion times in my life, usually against my will. And so,
how could you not like a song that sums up Hamlet as where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat?
That's funny. That's a great line from the song That's Entertainment. It is still funny. I don't need to hear that song anymore.
Fine.
I'm right about this.
If you must. We have letters.
We do. Here I am pulling them up and putting on my glasses. And I'm going to read them very soon, as soon as my thing stops spinning. Yeah. Here we go. Daniel says, Carousel. We talked about Carousel last week. It's got such a great score, but the movie is indeed out there. Shirley Jones's reaction when the daughter talks about being hit is truly disturbing. The play, at least as it's currently done, has managed to alleviate some of this, mostly through the reactions of both lead characters. Interestingly, in the original play it's based on,
Lilliam,
the character hits his daughter and is then sent to hell. So that was softened in the stage version. Yeah, you guys, Carousel, the one we talked about last week.
Bonkers.
It's bananas, yeah. Now, this letter is in reference to Shadi's letter about video games and how much screen time she should allow her kids.
Yes.
And apparently something I said on that episode was tweeted about. The quote was tweeted, and it got spread around. But I stand by it.
Yes.
And that quote was, I don't have any children, but I have lots of parenting advice. It was true last week. It's true this week. JD says, not to start an argument in your letters section, but I am also not a parent. Someone who grew up on video games and has numerous gamer friends, video games aren't really the problem. Too much of anything is a problem. Limiting screen time is important, but video games themselves aren't going to ruin children any more than comic books or rock and roll. Not all video games are gunshots and explosions, and not all gaming communities are full of toxic bros. Healthy environments exist in abundance and should be encouraged. Well, yeah, of course.
Yes. Sure. I think that's a given.
I think
the discussion was about...
Reasonable people know this,
I think. It was about the four-hour, you know, like, gaming sessions that her kid's friends...
Yeah. Your kid comes home from school and all they want to do is play games until dinner. Get out and rake those leaves. Take out the trash.
Help me fold this laundry.
We're going to play Scrabble for 30 minutes as a family. See? I got a lot of parenting advice.
There you go. Lovely.
But thank you, JD. Yes. I agree.
We also have...
Yeah, we have a five-star review.
A five-star review.
And it is from... Dubby Bug?
Sure.
I was trying to find out if that was an I or an L. I don't know. I don't know. Double Bug or Dubby Bug. It's Dubby Bug.
Mm. How bye, Frabens?
Outstanding host. Only one. Oh. There's no S on that word.
Okay.
Outstanding host.
Me, obviously.
We have to pick which one it is.
I pick me.
I pick you too.
No.
witty banter, great humor, silly at times, and most of all, knowledgeable. Thank you, Dubby Bug.
Yeah.
You forgot apologists for white liberalism. Don't forget.
Just that one time.
Not even that one time. Please.
I know. We were not.
We were not. Harumph.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you want to leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts, we will read it on the show.
Right.
Hey, we have a Patreon.
We do. It's at patreon.com/linoleumknife. You go there. You look at what we're offering for sale in our store of podcasts.
Yes.
We have many of them. Some of them are attractive. Some of them are vital.
All of them will fix your life.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's be like Masha on 9 Perfect Strangers. You came to us broken to be fixed. Have a smoothie.
Your Russian dosing, accent.
We're dosing you with
microdosing
psychedelics.
It's totally legal.
Now you will subscribe to Patreon.
I think your accent is perhaps better than Nicole's.
No, nothing is better than Nicole Kidman's accent.
Not on this show.
So we have a lot of podcasts.
Yes.
Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife, LKTV, Linoleum Knife and Fork, Linoleum Nights.
Mm-hmm.
For you racy adults.
That's right.
And
monthly club meetings.
Each one that you, each level you subscribe to is a different amount of money. If you want to buy it, we're selling it.
Yes.
The end. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Absolutely.
And now goodbye.
Check it. Wait,
forever.
check out our friends on the internet. Who shall I pick out this week? Sewers of Paris. Matt Baum does an extraordinary job of talking to gay men and interviewing them about their cultural histories.
Yes.
What art were they exposed to that sort of changed their lives, be it film, TV, music, visual arts, theater, whatever.
What is the media that made you?
Exactly. And his Patreon gets into a lot of interesting corners of queer history as well. You should check that out. Also want to mention again, the lovely Blue, who wrote our wonderful theme music, has a new album out called Six Tape, and he is selling it on his Bandcamp account, Blue, B-L-E-U, blue.bandcamp.com. Go check that out. It's a terrific album. I'm really enjoying it. And yeah, again, 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can leave that at Apple Podcasts. You can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, thelounge.com, Amazon Music, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. That's pretty much it. Until next time.
Goodbye.